The MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this week's edition of the MadTech Podcast. Our very special guest joining us for today's edition is Alex Khan, Group MD EMEA for Unruly Group International. Hello, Alex.
Hi, how are you doing? Nice to see you again, Rachel.
Yes, and you. And actually, Alex, I should have explained, I'll explain to this as you've got a secondary job title, Head of IT.
I've actually got a third one as well, because it's all of Unruly's business outside of North America, not just EMEA.
Oh, yes, sorry. Did I not say global? Yes, sorry.
You can use Intergalactic Web Warlord. That's just as easy.
True to Rachel Smith form, always cocking up people's job titles. And thankfully, joined by slightly more competent ExchangeWire colleague, Lindsay Rowntree, over in the Wealth of Social Studios. Hello, Lindsay.
I think more competent is very polite, very complimentary. I'll take it.
Let's get straight into the news stories for the week. First news story I wanted to chat through with the two of you is news that Visa has purchased an NFT called CryptoPunk number 7610 for $150,000. So an NFT, as I'm sure many people in the industry know, but some might not, is a non-fungible token, which is a one-of-a-kind digital item that's essentially a unique entry on a blockchain ledger. And the blockchain ledger is also used to issue cryptocurrency. And it's the unique nature of these NFTs, so the fact that they're certified unique and they can't be interchanged, that's, amongst other things, fueling their association currently with valuing and selling digital artwork. So that's what makes this news story a little bit interesting. There seems to be a clear benefit for content creators and digital artists in the world of NFTs who can obviously have their work and their content pieces valued in addition to making money from selling them. And they can also, it so turns out, make follow-up license fees from the onward resale of those items, and all associated with the certification of this piece of content's original nature. But I guess the real question concerning this news story is, what's the benefit to Visa of having an NFT? Presumably, they can decide to sell CryptoPunk 7610 and retain or increase its value. But I guess the sort of wider story here, at least for NFTs as digital assets and also their growing popularity, is that this kind of virtual content creation, the valuing, sort of buying and selling of virtual content, whether that's original art pieces or other originally curated content, is sort of contributing to this wider decentralization of the industry in general. So enabling content owners and content providers to have full control over their digital assets. My question to the two of you is, why has Visa done this? They say it's to test the infrastructure process and sort of the value of buying, owning, and also presumably onward selling NFTs, because they recognise that it's an area of growing importance and value to their customer base and the wider market of consumers they're trying to reach. But is it perhaps also maybe a brand play, just them having an opportunity to kind of get on the NFT bandwagon? And I'm also interested to know what you think the value of NFTs will be to the advertising and marketing industry and, I guess, blockchain more widely. I mean, we first started talking about the potential value of blockchain to the advertising industry some sort of 3 or 4 years ago, when it was heralded as a measure to address things like transparency and controlling and containing and shutting down fraud. But I'm really interested to hear if you've got a point of view on where blockchain can potentially take the advertising industry today, 3, 4 years on. Alex, particularly since you're the view in the Unruly offices in London looks very much like the set of a Bond film, we're going to start with you. I bet you've got an NFT, haven't you? You've bought an NFT.
No, I haven't actually. I tend to stay clear of NFTs and cryptos until there's a more knowledgeable viewpoint for my own personal investments. But look, I guess, it, put simply, it's a way for content creators, artists, media, media companies to some extent to put a value on their creation and their work, and to then have that value bought and sold. Now, the reality is with this NFT CryptoPunk 761, where are the previous 760, and therefore what's unique about them? On this particular one, I think the uniqueness is the fact that it's a CryptoPunk, as in it's a punk. And it's about proving the theory that NFTs can provide a service to what is ultimately Visa consumers and Visa clients. And if you are a content creator and you are looking to be paid a fair amount for your work, be that a journalist, be that a digital artist, I guess to some extent, be that even Banksy, you could create an NFT and that then derives a market value. Now, where it works for advertising is you can already see certain companies have invested in providing NFTs for their paywalls in order to consume the content that they create. Now, if you're a media owner and you're using independent journalists, this creates a whole path of simplicity to working with independents and freelancers, because they provide the, traditionally you would provide the work, you would invoice them, the work would be checked, and then they would be paid, and that would be it. And then that work could be replicated tens of thousands of times. In this case, you provide a bit of work, you create the NFT, the work is purchased for that NFT, and then the boundaries of that NFT constitute how many times that work can be consumed. If the work is then sold on, for example, to syndication, it then has to be purchased again. So there is a fairer mechanism for the content creators. And what it's essentially doing is providing, I guess, media owners in a world that we currently live in, where everyone's working from home and everyone is potentially working, particularly journalists as a freelancer, you're in a position to provide work and be paid for it in an equitable way. The example that that I saw were Forbes, where they're using it for their paywall, and some of the content creators are on a 50-50 revenue share. Okay, if you're getting 50-50 of your content's value or your creative work's value, you're going to produce better work. So I think it has the potential to stimulate the ecosystem for a much better consumer experience. The only area I would say that that could cause some challenges and concerns from a media usage point of view is around the safety and the data privacy. But look, I mean, we're working through those challenges across the board, where if you consider how the media industry has had to deal with COPPA in the US, for example, GDPR in Europe. So it's all for, I guess, developing the industry and making the industry in a better environment. And then, of course, once that's solved, it's how many people really are going to start delving into using their NFTs.
You know, you make some good points there. It's definitely a kind of a sort of a tool, if you like, a fairly liberating tool potentially for content owners and content creators. But, you know, to what extent will it become commonplace, and will it become, you know, building subscription models using cryptocurrencies is a great idea, but how many people have cryptocurrency available to be taken up a subscription? So it'll be interesting to see how that unfolds. And also, that's another good point that you make, I think, as well, Alex, the whole idea of people being a little bit sort of hesitant around the world of cryptocurrencies and NFTs associated with the advertising and marketing industry, because there's concern about data privacy and, you know, controlling fraud. Well, they're issues we haven't yet solved across the board, full stop. So it ought not to prevent the industry from experimenting in other fields. Yeah. Lindsay, are you in the market for an NFT?
I am not in the market for an NFT. I do love the look of those CryptoPunks. They're very fascinating. I love the fact that the one that Visa bought was described as one of 3,840 female CryptoPunks with mohawk, clown eyes green, and hot lipstick. So if you haven't seen it in the flesh or digitally, obviously, then that's you know, I can conjure up an image of what it looks like. It's a very, yeah, very flattering. What a specimen. But I don't, it's taken me a bit of time and taken me a bit of reading to really understand the desire for NFTs in the kind of digital art world. As someone whose walls are adorned with actual art, it's taken me a while to kind of get on board with it. But as I'm reading more about it, I'm starting to. And I guess those that exist in the crypto world and those that exist in the gaming world as well, are we quite au fait with this and quite comfortable with buying things of this nature that are, you know, a one-off in terms of a digital fingerprint or digital footprint. That can be replicated time and time again. The same can be said for actually any physical piece of art as well. You can have a £10 Banksy poster on your wall. Doesn't mean you actually own a Banksy. It's a similar kind of thing that I guess people would just need time to get their heads around. And I guess Visa getting involved in it is for them to try and get their heads around it too, because they're going to have clients that will start asking and start wondering, or even buying NFTs with Visa cards. They want to understand what it is they're getting into. I think that the thing to really kind of to keep mindful of is that this is still so nascent and still so niche, the NFT perspective, but also just anything kind of decentralized blockchain ledger in general, that, you know, in terms of buying an NFT, are you buying it to flip it and get loads of money from it? There probably isn't a big enough audience for you to do that yet. But if you were looking to do so, you know, 10, 15 years down the line, who knows what that digital artwork you bought could be worth. And I think that, to Alex's point about equitability, I think that's a very interesting point. Like, you can see that from the royalty aspect of digital artwork versus physical artwork, the fact that because everything is on a ledger, so everything's bought on this ledger, they can see when it's been bought, when it's been sold, who buys it, who sells it across the entire chain. Each time that it's sold, the original artist will get 10% royalties. And that's fascinating. And that, I think, can be passed down to many other aspects of how people get paid in other industries too. And also, again, to one of Alex's points about how we can manage subscription businesses within digital publishing. I don't know if kind of the mainstream publishers would be anywhere near doing that kind of thing yet. There's no point because their clientele aren't going to be probably, you know, having great access to crypto wallets. But for those that are more niche, more B2B, certainly in the crypto world, there's no harm at all in actually kind of building subscription businesses and subscription models off the back of blockchain. It makes a lot of sense. So I think that it's still really new, but I'm still trying to get my head around a lot of it. But the more I read of it, the more I think I'm getting to grips with it. Not enough to own an NFT. Hell no, but I'll get there.
Yeah. I think it brings up an interesting question around what do you do once you purchase an NFT? If you buy a subscription to, the whole point of NFTs is they're unique, right? It's a unique piece of code that sits on a blockchain ledger that is fully transparent and traceable. So you buy one of these NFTs, forget cyberpunk, but let's say you buy an NFT for Forbes. There's no secondary market for that, really. How is that subscription model going to work with the NFT? It's like, okay, I buy a used subscription to whichever I want, to the Forbes suite of magazines, or I buy a year's subscription to whichever gamer on a live stream that I want to follow. What happens when that year's subscription runs out? Do I pay for the same NFT again? Is it a one-off cost? What happens to that? Does it become sequential? So I end up going from Cyberpunk 761 to Cyberpunk 950? Again, and there's just these dotted chains around that. There's a lot of questions where, in theory, it sounds great and amazing. It makes life a lot easier because we're no longer having to deal with direct debits and we're no longer having to deal with transfers and everything. But equally, there's a lot of questions it throws up in terms of what happens to that NFT when I've finished the service that I've acquired, or I've finished the article or the content, I've consumed it, and therefore I no longer need it. And those are the sort of questions, I think, for it to become a mass product, those are the sort of questions that need to be answered and fully transparent. So going back to Visa, I think it's perfectly sensible, probably a good idea for them to understand how it's going to work, because ultimately, as Lindsay said, people are probably going to buy if they're going to on their credit card. But they're not going to do that until all these questions are answered, or there's greater clarity around what happens on a secondary market, or if I wanted to cash in, when it comes to things like live streaming, publisher subscription, podcasts, etc., you guys, ExchangeWire, could start charging NFTs, accepting NFTs for access to the MadTech podcast.
I mean, what a great idea.
You know, yeah, I mean, look, I think it's worth a tenner of anyone's money.
Tenner, Alex, so badly undervaluing us. We can do a CryptoPunk version of Kieron's face.
Can you imagine that? Put a mohawk on
him. That'd be hilarious. With the red lipstick.
You'd be a bigotry, 2 pints of beer in his hand.
I have to share a little bit of office life with the listeners because we've rearranged the exchange wire offices, rearranged the desks. It's all a bit of an awkward setup in our office. And due to many reasons that I probably don't need to go into, Kieran's an awkward desk partner, shall we say. So we've siphoned him off into the what looks like the receptionist desk. So he's the first person that anyone sees when they come in the door. Safe to say, if he was actually the receptionist, I'm not quite sure that ExchangeWire would still be an operational business. But anyway, we enjoy parking him in the corner. So I think that's a great idea. CryptoPunk version of Kira. I think this all, you know, draws a really interesting picture that I feel as though there's still too much unknown about the world of cryptocurrencies in general and the possibilities of blockchain and how the technology can be best utilized, because I think most people can get around their heads of an idea that an NFT is associated with something like a piece of art that is, you know, unique and individual and has some intrinsic value, which might just be that you like the look of it, never mind what its actual monetary value might be and what you can do with it. But then actually thinking about crypto tokens in exchange for services is a whole other world, as you've just outlined, Alex. And it feels like all of that just needs to become so much clearer before it will become a mass market opportunity. And, you know, I can see a world where that's not very far away. I mean, I still feel as though even 12 months ago, I probably used to walk around with more physical cash in my wallet than I do now. I very rarely go anywhere near physical cash at all. I've almost forgotten what some of the banknotes look like. So how is the transfer of cash between accounts for services that different to the transfer of virtual currencies for services? But I think it's that element, isn't it? It's the, is this a transfer or is this a one-off purchase? Is this an individual item that can't be replaced, or can I trade it for something else? And, you know, my understanding, unfortunately, of NFTs and cryptocurrency is way too basic to be able to answer any of those questions.
I think for those of us that exist in a physical world, owning physical things, and also we're still used to paying with money regulated by banks and regulated by governments, actually this world of owning things digitally and also paying for things via a decentralized kind of non-government regulated currency is mind-boggling. And I think that because we're so used to, particularly in the West, where we're still very used to banks and credit cards and not even paying for things with our phone, even when we pay with our phone, we're still actually physically paying with a card of some sort. It's less like that in the likes of Asia, but in Europe and the US, the US isn't even getting rid of credit card strips into 2024. Like, they are very behind the likes of Europe. Like, this is all going to be a minefield for a long time to come, I reckon.
Yeah, I mean, look, it also kind of, what we hope it doesn't happen is it doesn't drive it to a niche service or a niche market, because you know, if you look at some of the deals that have been done, you've got people like the New York Times. And on there, Kevin Roose's column, he put his column up for sale via an NFT, which is basically, you know, under the title, buy this column on the blockchain, sold for over $500,000. Now, that's great in principle, because he earns good money out of that. I'm sure the New York Times have earned their share out of that. But what are you buying? Is he going to write a column every day, every week, every month? In which case, as a potential a media creator or as a potential publisher, you now have an opportunity where you can say, well, over the lifetime of an employee or a bunch of freelancers, I can equate to what the cost is going to be if, in this scenario, I have exclusive access to this content creation for 12, 24, 36 months. But again, still niche. Because not everybody's going to have a strong enough repertoire and a strong enough reputation to demand $560,000 for a column that they're going to write. So, exactly.
And also, who's in the market to spend that kind of money as well, right?
Yeah, I'm sure the New York Times won't be very happy if it gets bought by someone else who's in direct competition with them. But again, it's about freedom, it's about the transparency, and it's about the opportunity. And if you present the opportunity to the market, there will always be a certain percentage of the population that will grasp the opportunity and be early adopters. You know, think back to the early mid-80s when the iPod came out. You got to have a situation where who thought, well, who's going to listen to music on this little thing? Now, all of a sudden, you can't walk around without having it on your phone. Well, it's all migrated to your phone now. So I think the early adopters will drive the market. To Lindsay's point, the mass will see exactly what develops, because in general, it's human nature to want a bit more regulation, a bit more structure, a bit more tried and tested, especially when it comes to money that is hard enough to come by and very easy to lose. So, I think it's a case of watch this space. It's interesting to see what Visa, or it will be interesting to see what Visa make of it.
Okay, I'm going to move us into further conversation about the world, about the sort of world of unregulated metaphorical existence. An interesting article appearing in the WSJ this week, talking about the metaverse as becoming the next big tech battleground for the likes of Facebook,
Roblox.
Because Roblox sounds a bit stupid, you know, sounds a bit like something else, doesn't it?
Yeah, construction Rolex. Company or something. Exactly. So Roblox, gaming and immersive entertainment company, as well as some other US companies such as the Match Group and Microsoft, all vying for position in their intention to enable consumers to access and explore this new virtual world, or rather growing virtual world, otherwise known as the metaverse. So Facebook is using its Oculus product, Oculus headsets, to build and enable access to virtual workplaces called Horizon Workrooms, which they claim are going to be one of the most popular ways people are going to be interacting in the metaverse. So that's facilitating hybrid and remote working in more of a...
They would, wouldn't they?
Yeah, of course, exactly, in more of a virtual environment. Gaming companies have attracted a lot of attention and probably equal amounts of funding connected with the prospect of enabling tech companies to become a hub for immersive experiences. So, and of course, you know, virtual currencies, cryptocurrencies and NFTs that we've all been just talking about are expected to be a big feature of the world of the metaverse as well. So with its infinite prospects, I suppose, what opportunities, I'm interested to hear from the two of you guys, what opportunities do you think the metaverse, in theory, are going to be able to offer brands? But I guess more importantly, where on earth would brands and marketers start when it comes to trying to sort of establish some kind of presence in a metaverse environment? It feels like this is where the gaming industry has been quite a sort of logical and useful route for brands to enter, whether that's just via, you know, in-app and in-gaming experiences that have become more and more immersive and are associated with virtual reality and augmented reality, but also because social experiences in a gaming environment are becoming more and more commonplace as well. So, you know, we've already seen that happening over the last probably 2 years to 12 months with well-known artists performing concerts in gaming environments, in a virtual gaming environment. So, your views on what you think the opportunities are for brands in the metaverse, and I guess any perspectives you've got on some practical points where people can start. Yeah, Lindsay.
Great.
Thanks.
Thanks for that. Yeah, brilliant. So I think that from a brand perspective, I think there are so many brands that haven't had the confidence to really try out gamification in general yet, kind of in a more known universe, let alone a metaverse, that I think is going to be a long time coming for them to really understand how they can embrace that. But I think also they'll want to go where the consumers are. they're not even doing that yet when it comes to gaming, frankly. So this will take a long time for a lot of brands to kind of get involved. But that, having said that, a lot of big brands will probably jump at the chance if they know that this is the next big thing. And those brands are ones that are investing heavily in the likes of esports. And we talked about them in the podcast recently, and how big that area for growth is, particularly in the likes of APAC, where we're seeing massive growth in esports. And actually, that's a common thing, and brands in local brands in that region are already getting heavily involved. It's actually kind of the more Western conversations where kind of brands are a little bit more nervous to really kind of dip a toe in the water in terms of getting into gamification in general. And I think that, as you said, Rachel, the metaverse will be more in tune with a gaming industry anyway, and the gaming universe anyway, because it's not much of a leap. Films like Ready Player One, which I've watched and was like, there's no effing way I want to be involved in a world where that exists like that, where you actually aren't sure what is real and what isn't real anymore, but you are sure, you can tell what is a metaverse and what is physical, but the lines blur so quickly as to how you operate in both of them. I think that there'll be many brands out there that would probably think the same thing and wouldn't really understand it. And I think there's a long way for them to go. But for the likes of Facebook, this is obviously huge. And as you mentioned, they're going big on virtual reality and augmented reality, as are the likes of Microsoft and Nvidia and everything else from the middleware perspective, the tech perspective and the kind of the front facing perspective. But I think that in a world where the likes of Facebook, Apple, Google, you know, they aren't players in the ecosystem. They are the ecosystem, but the ecosystem is getting more and more regulated by governments, regulatory bodies more generally, either cross-region or in market. The metaverse for them represents a bit like blockchain represents for them an unregulated or not market by market regulated existence, where they can actually be the controlling force and they can almost create their own economy. And I think for them, that makes it very, very interesting. It's getting the consumers on board that I think will be the biggest challenge, because they're not yet like, and the Horizon Workrooms, whatever the hell it's called, the Facebook thing where you've got the legless bodies in a meeting room with you, you know, you can have a meeting that way, but you can't work that way. So you can't replace an office environment. You can replace a meeting room environment, because you're not going to actually work that way. I don't think so. People that are avid gamers already use the likes of Discord, which is a communication app when you're gaming, to communicate in the work environment. So I hate to stereotype, but I know a lot of IT teams that use Discord to communicate all day long at work, because you're always on and you can just chat to people whenever you want to, but you're not actually, so it's a bit like an office environment, but you aren't actually kind of listening into everything they're doing, but it's an easy way of being able to communicate rather than having to jump on a Hangout or on a Zoom call the whole time. So for them, it's a really easy way of communicating, and they're used to doing it in a gaming environment. I think that for them, this could be the next stage to be on that. But for the rest of us, what the likes of Facebook needs is probably another pandemic a few years down the line, where there's no choice but for us to kind of go, right, this time we have to go really virtual, and the metaverse is the answer, and that will then probably kind of force the change along. Otherwise, I don't see it happening in the next few years.
That all sounds quite terrifying, to be honest, Lindsay. I was hoping the metaverse might be something to look forward to in some respects. But,
well, I'm not looking forward to it. I'm a bit terrified by it.
I think it is. I kind of agree with what Lindsay's saying, but I think it will fly, no pun intended, for a number of industries. Firstly, gaming is an obvious one, but I think e-commerce and retail will embrace. Mm-hmm. Because if you think about it, given the pandemic, it's only going to accelerate the consumers, those who are nervous and those of a certain age who, like myself, who are used to going to a shop and trying something on, and then you decide whether you buy it or not. In the metaverse, you can go to any given shop you want to at any point and look at any product and have it actually sized to fit you. You then decide, you can then choose what environments you wear it in to decide whether you like it, and then you buy it, all from the comfort of your home. I think that's massive opportunity for retail. And the same with e-commerce. You make a decision on whether you buy something or not based on your research, what friends have told you, and the reviews you see on websites. Similarly for hotels. Well, what if you can actually now, through the metaverse, go in and actually use that product, look at that hotel room, experience that cabin, your business class seat or your first class cabin on a cruise, if heaven forbid you ever wanted to go on a cruise. But this is where I think there's huge opportunities. Yes, of course, gaming is an opportunity because you've got a whole generation, two generations almost, of people who understand what it's like to immerse yourself in a game and play for 6 or 7 hours. And so the metaverse is going to accelerate and exist in there. But equally, you've got a huge amount of the population at a global level who want to have that experience of buying clothes without getting home and then realizing you don't like it or it doesn't fit as it should have done or did do in the shop or whatever reason you want to send it back, which is currently what's happening. Whereas in this particular scenario, it's kind of like real world meets Westworld off TV in real life. That's what the metaverse is providing you. It's providing consumers with an experience that they otherwise wouldn't get and the ability to feel comfortable about goods and services that they otherwise wouldn't necessarily buy before they make that financial investment. So there's a certain amount of comfort in doing that. And if you look at the big works, that I don't know if you've ever been to Tottenham Court Road recently, but you've got Outernet there, which are basically redeveloped the whole of Tottenham Court Road and the Music Street above the tube station. And they will have arguably Europe's or even the world's largest 3D out-of-home video screens there. You know, the ones that you see where it looks like the spaceship's coming out onto the street and all this kind of stuff, that will be there. But equally, what they will have is a certain number of retailers in there that provide you this metaverse or augmented reality experience of trying on the clothes, being properly measured so that what you see in the website or what you see in the picture actually does fit you, as opposed to how we're all used to buying predefined sizes that may or may not fit you. And so I see the huge possibilities there, huge opportunities. And that's happening now at Tottenham Court Road with a number of retailers there. Now people can go in and experience it. But if you think about it, for the last 2 or 3 years, how many opportunities have you had with the likes of Nike and Adidas to walk into their shops, design your own trainers, and within 2 hours they're there?
True.
I can totally see that. And also, you know, I mean, and there's plenty of other examples of how useful that will be. Like, for example, moving into a new house, buying furniture, you know, doing all of that sort of stuff that you now are more increasingly doing online anyway, but still feel a bit hesitant about because they're big purchases or because you can't possibly know what it's actually going to be like until it turns up and what if it's the wrong thing. So anything that can assist you in making that as real as possible could be really compelling.
Even buying the house now, you can go through using metaverse, you can go into that house and experience what that house has. Now, for some people, you need that physical presence to understand whether you associate with the house or not. But think about it. The vast majority of people, if we think about what everyone's gone through the last 20 months, the vast majority of people would love the opportunity to immerse themselves and feel like they're physically in that house they're viewing and understand whether they want to buy it or not. Whereas at the moment, there's a lot of people who are probably sitting there today thinking, why did I buy that house online without seeing it? It's old world. It's not right. You know, equally, there'll be some who are happy. I'm just trying to say that there are opportunities for certain markets or certain verticals. Gaming, obviously, housing, definitely, retail for sure, and e-commerce. So there's four where that could easily scale to be multi-billion-dollar business. But we're still thinking about the same old things. How do we make sure that privacy is looked after? How do we make sure data is secure? How do we make sure that once you bought a piece of clothing that's tailored for you, those details are either kept anonymized and secret, or they're dispensed with, and you go back and every time you buy, you register. All these things need to be looked at. But I do think that there is an opportunity for, in certain verticals, for the metaverse to scale quite quickly. In those verticals, and clearly Epic Games do, because they've set aside $1 billion. To provide a metaverse experience or environment and to fulfill their ambitions. around their Fortune game. Now, if you think about how big Fortune is as a game, imagine if you're that one or two generations that I just spoke about who play Fortune 10 hours a day, every day of the week, and you now are able to drop yourself into that environment. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, I'm not sure. But now we're experiencing, you know, mainstream stars, as you said, Lindsay, doing concerts in that environment, and people will log in and not necessarily play the game, but they will attend the concert. What else are they going to be able to do? It's almost like taking your phone app and creating a virtual world for you where you can do your shopping, you can buy your clothes, you can do everything. So the possibilities for good are endless, but there's equally one, the other side of the coin is there needs to be a certain amount of regulation and security built in.
And that is the thing that is going to be really interesting in these early days, particularly if the metaverse as an environment is considered an opportunity for big tech, highly commercialized companies like Facebook, et cetera, Microsoft, others, whatever. They'll be looking for, you know, an opportunity to make money and be less, I'm not, you know, trying to cast aspersions on them as companies, but perhaps less interested in sort of containing and controlling the potentially negative aspects, more focused certainly in the early days on how they're going to make the big bucks, right? And I guess, you know, a little bit like the world of cryptocurrencies, it still feels underdeveloped to a degree that means that it's difficult for those of us that aren't already quite familiar with interacting in a very virtual environment, you know, feel a bit perplexed about it and wonder and start to worry about the possibilities for the negative side of things over the positive side. I think the positive stuff, 100%. I mean, I think I've said this before on podcasts, you know, I'm a university student of the 90s, so I spent a lot of time watching Star Trek Next Generation. And I'm telling you now, if there was something that could get me into a holodeck, I'd be there. I'm sure it's the same as the metaverse. Yeah. That idea that you could take yourself somewhere else without actually taking yourself somewhere else, you could just do it in a virtual environment. I can totally see the value of that.
Well, this is almost, we're almost Blade Runner-esque here. The potential for the metaverse is to provide that kind of experience. You're walking down the high street, it picks up on either your mobile phone or it picks up on anything, any personal data that identifies to you, and out pops a hologram and tells you exactly what it is you need to know. And is way more convincing at getting you to go into the shop or to try something on than a poster would be, or indeed any form of advertising. So we're kind of at that situation where, as I said, there is a huge potential for it. And for those of us who are students of the early 90s, then we get the...
You're talking about yourself there, Alex, aren't you? Not me.
I'm not commenting on that. Then you get to have that Blade Runner type experience where you can see and try and.
Well, and which is, for those of us that can remember all of those films, is quite exciting. The idea that you could realise that in your lifetime is quite exciting, right? But that leads me to another thing, which is that I think, you know, young people and young teenagers of today will surely have an expectation that they can interact in this environment, because it's becoming so immersed with their natural day-to-day practices, such as gaming, but also the idea of just being able to create these virtual personalities and being able to access these virtual experiences will just be an expectation, don't you think, Lindsay?
I agree.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
I do. I think also when I think of metaverse, I always think of a video that was brought out a few years ago. I think it's by a South American content creator who basically, I think of the metaverse, how it intertwines with the real world. And the video basically was a person going to, I think she was like an Instacart delivery person. So she's basically wearing a virtual headset or a kind of goggle, like Google Glass type thing, doing her usual daily routine, getting on the bus. And wherever she goes, she's seeing tokens to collect things like vouchers. And there's like things popping up a bit like you're kind of living in Mario, but you're actually doing it in the real world as well. And that, I think, is something else that, so you've got the, you haven't just got the physical world, then the metaverse, which is connected, but actually how do you overlay the metaverse into the physical world? So when you are going around the supermarket, you're seeing offers, actually virtual offers pop up above products, or you're seeing things like telling you what you can do with this, or recipe ideas that are actually literally, or, oh yes, if you take this virtual cat around with you, you get 100 bonus points, or this is where you need to go next. And that video always sticks with me whenever we talk about this kind of stuff, because I kind of think that seems to me to be something that could actually also be more realistically possible, not just existing, coexisting in a metaverse as well as in a physical universe, but how you actually combine the two together.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to move this on to third news story, which hopefully brings us into the world, or brings us into the topic and the world of regulation, since we are pondering that in any case. So news released this week that China has implemented data privacy legislation to rival GDPR. That's not the point of it, but it so happens that it's very similar to GDPR in terms of its legislative control. So this is a law that was passed earlier in August, and it's going to come into effect on November the 1st. Similarly to GDPR, it's going to require consumer consent to access and use personal data, as well as a stipulation that companies keep the collection and use of this data to a minimum. However, unlike GDPR and any of the other similar laws that exist in the US, the Chinese government agencies are expected to be exempt to this legislation. So they will still have the ability to gather data and use it for their own purposes. I suppose more importantly, I can't say that's actually been confirmed. It's just been a speculation. I guess more importantly, the point is this law will apply to private companies in the first instance. So it brings together a number of pre-existing pieces of legislation which attempted to tackle consumer privacy, but in a very ineffective fashion. So they were considered a bit too disparate to adequately deal with some of the pervasive issues that Chinese consumers were complaining about, which was things like online fraud, data theft, and pervasive use of data collection by private companies. So two of the particularly controversial areas that Chinese consumers were getting irritated about was facial recognition technology, which is being used by, for security purposes by private technology companies that were providing security access to people's apartment buildings and so forth. But the argument was that they were using this biometric data, or they were retaining this biometric data for their own use, and it was in the hands of a commercial company as opposed to a government agency. One of the other major complaints was something that's known as algorithmic discrimination, which was a number of online marketplaces designing specific algorithms to offer products at varying prices to consumers based on their online behaviour. Again, you know, a whole load of sort of tracking data in the hands of private companies used for discriminatory purposes, which are also sort of considered slightly anti-competitive. So in effect, this is China completely cracking down on companies who up to now have been able to use consumer data more or less how they liked. So companies that violate this law will be fined up to $7.7 million, or 5% of the previous year's revenue. So interested in your thoughts on whether this is good news for Chinese consumers. It certainly seems that it is, but also how might it impact technology innovation in China? So there's been a lot of talk across a number of media outlets over the last sort of, you know, 3 or 4 months about how China's tackling their own homegrown technology companies from an anti-competition point of view, as well as now from a data privacy point of view. And the underlying sort of thesis there is that previously, when companies were allowed to more or less do what they wanted from a data collection and application perspective, that fueled a lot of technology innovation and meant that it accelerated a lot of technology tools and advances in China much faster than in other markets. Do you think that will drop off now because we're starting to see the Chinese government really crack down on things like data privacy and also anti-competition? Or is it just a sort of a matter-of-fact issue that's come with a bit more maturation in the Chinese consumer market? And I guess, does it also maybe paint the picture, mixing metaphors all over the place here, of Beijing being more prepared to crack down on big tech than, say, some Western governments have been prepared to crack down on their own homegrown big tech companies? And we hear a lot of talk and quite a bit of action, arguably, from European countries and also the US in trying to tackle the dominance of big tech companies. But are we seeing the Chinese government lead the way with really sort of putting a little bit more effort and oomph behind their legislative control than we're seeing in Western countries? Alex, what's your perspective?
Well, yeah, I mean, firstly, I think it's kind of ironic when you consider, having been to various parts of China several times, you can't actually spend cash in China. It's all done through your mobile phone and predominantly done through WeChat, where you, like 90% of the Chinese population, live their life through WeChat. They order their taxis, they buy their groceries, their takeaways, everything is done through WeChat. So how does that happen? Well, it's driven off data that they willingly give WeChat to have a better experience. And China's always been one of those markets where you look at a certain level of freedom or availability of anonymized data creates a far better user experience, and WeChat is held up as the shining example of that. Now, fast forward to today, and you've got Chinese consumers saying, I don't like the fact that I'm being subject to various algorithms. I don't like the fact that my bio data is kept. I don't like forgetting that they willingly bought into this in order to have a more automated and personal experience, so that offers were only sent to them that are personal or relevant to their life. So I think it's kind of ironic to do that. And then you think to yourself, really, are the Chinese government doing this for the benefit of the Chinese people? Or are the Chinese government doing this because they've got several companies that are becoming so big and powerful that they need to basically bring them back into line? And that is that's probably one of the questions. Now, should the practices in China be tightened up? Of course they should. I mean, and nobody goes to China looking to do business without knowing that there are several different ways of doing business in China. But the reality is any form of regulation and governance is a better thing, because China has a great history of being able to innovate, develop, and deliver very, very quickly. Now, has that been helped by the fact that the data laws have been fairly loose from a digital ecosystem? Probably from a development of technology that will play its part in the metaverse, most definitely. But it still provides a great user experience. So I think the real question here is, yes, some regulation is good, but is it being hidden behind the Chinese consumer demands? For really, they want to get some of the larger companies, Tencent, WeChat, Alibaba, under a bit more control, given the size that they've grown to and the actual volume of money that they can control and the influence they have, not only on the domestic market, but in some international markets. And can they be draconian? Yes, of course they can. Anyone who's ever done business in China knows the Chinese government can be draconian. You only got to look at their taxi app, Didi, that exploded onto the scene and was seen as a potential and viable rival to Uber, that fell foul of the Chinese government and how it operated, and Didi no longer exists.
Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting, isn't it, to think about that from a sort of Western government's perspective. I just can't ever imagine any Western government ever having that level of control and power over private companies. Lindsay, what do you think?
Yeah, I think I agree with everything Alex said. And to paraphrase UK grime artist Stormzy, I think China tech is getting way too big for its boots. It's never too big for the boot. And I'm interested in what the Chinese government's long game is here, because they clearly are kind of looking at these big tech companies. And if you tie in this news about their data protection laws with the kind of the whole VIE structure that's allowed big Chinese tech companies to go and go public, like Didi, as Alex was just talking about, in other stock exchanges in the West, and that kind of being brought into disrepute, and the China base potentially saying that all these companies that have ever gone public in other countries outside China could be illegal. And anyone who's actually got any stock or shares in these companies is probably worthless. You know, it makes me think that China's looking at these big companies and going, yeah, okay, we've seen what the likes of Facebook and Google have done to the rest of the world. We will not let China do that to our government. We want these companies to do that to the Chinese government. We need to take action now and bring them back in and make them be doing things that actually benefit China and aren't just doing things the rest of the world. And, you know, even the rumours around Jack Ma disappearing for about 3 months, and now he's come back and he's talking about doing things for his doing things locally, doing things that are important to where he's from and actually helping his local community. Yeah.
Where he's got a social conscience.
Yeah. Where's that come from? Sorry, you were actually planning on kind of taking over the US not a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
So I really feel like China are really clamping down and almost trying, they're almost looking at, it feels like, and again, this is Western perspective because I've not done business in China personally. Having spent time in Asia, kind of hearing kind of how it operates as a market over there is absolutely fascinating. I'm always fascinated by it. And I think the West is generally scared of China and doesn't need to be as scared as it is, but it is also a government to be very mindful of that they as Alex said, they are draconian. They can and will act in a draconian way if they feel they need to. They're looking at these companies and going, actually, yes, we've been able to foster innovation. That innovation's helped. That's been global innovation. That's helped us massively, but helped everybody else massively too. We don't like the control we're losing over here. Let's take it all back in again. And I think from the consumer perspective, I don't necessarily believe that China is thinking much about its consumers, but this does help. It does help its consumers. But of course, the big thing here is the speculation that the government will still have access and will use that access to all that data in the first place.
Exactly. Yeah. You've got to remember that at the end of the day, China is the first and foremost a communist party, a communist-led country. And when you have a country that is producing, I can't remember what the stat was, I think it's 100 new millionaires a week.
Wow.
As a communist country, you are somewhat concerned about that, I would imagine, at the People's Politburo. And how do you get that under control? Because the genie's out of the bottle. People have got a taste for it, and they like the fact that they can buy Teslas and Ferraris and BMWs and Mercedes and all this kind of stuff. You only got to go to Beijing and go to the car showrooms and you'll see, yes, you'll see some excellent domestic Chinese brands there charging exorbitant amounts for fully electric cars, but you'll see a lot more Western and European cars and fashion brands and so forth. Every fashion brand's biggest market is China. So it is a case of how do we put the genie back in the bottle? Okay, well, let's regulate the three biggest countries or the biggest digital companies without naming any. Let's regulate digital because that then gives us a way of keeping direct line of sight on the Chinese population and everyone who's a member of the Communist Party, which technically most Chinese are. So you then see to yourself, okay, the government are playing to the, what I suspect are the minority of complaints from Chinese consumers, but in the long-term play is they now have a direct window through this law of being able to keep control of and use all data that is collected to ensure that they are able to police their country in a communist abiding way. And that's kind of pretty much the basis of it.
And when you put it like that, Alex, it shouldn't be a surprise to anyone, really. I think it's probably the biggest surprise has been how China, sort of the sort of quasi-capitalist element of China's economy was let to flourish for so long, right? I mean, I think that surprised everybody rowing back, you know, sort of 10, 15 years used to be one of the biggest topics of conversation about global politics is, oh, my God, I can't believe how wealthy Chinese people are becoming these days and how prominent they are in exactly the way that you've described, Alex, massive purchases of global luxury brands, both within China and also traveling around the world doing that as well, right? That was all just such a source of fascination to all of us that, you know, that there could be communist country producing so many millionaires, right?
Well, who's one of the world's biggest lenders of money? It's the Chinese government.
Yeah. Exactly. So that's
part of West Africa's built with Chinese money.
Yeah. And a big chunk of Australia's road infrastructure. So, you know, the thing is they've invested everywhere, right? And so that brings me to something I was thinking just listening to the two of you speak about everything you've mentioned there, which is that this is all about finding the fine line because – you know, I think the Chinese government's intentions are clear, as really nicely summarised by you both there. But I guess the fine line is in doing enough to feel that they've got control over the situation whilst not stifling their economic opportunities, right? For themselves, the Chinese government, but ergo also their citizens and potentially international businesses that they want to interact with. That's what will be interesting, is seeing how all of that unfolds in the next couple of years. And conversely, seeing how all of that gets played out in Western democratic governments who are, it's fair to say, massively struggling with trying to develop a way to regulate, frankly, big tech companies that have also gotten out of control just in a completely different environment, right?
Yeah.
So, agreed. Yeah, super interesting times. Right, we're running tight on time, so I'm going to move us on to the second part of the podcast. Alex, please tell us what you've been up to since we last chatted with you in your global role at Unruly.
So pretty much continuing on from when I was last on, we are putting out some new products. We are making sure that the transition of Unruly from being a single product offering niche player is fully landed now to being a multi-format, multi-platform or omni-channel provider, SSP provider for our clients. And rolling that out at across our international markets, of which we have three in Asia Pacific and two in Europe, and obviously some of those are hubs, so they encompass multi markets as well. So that's really taken up a lot of my time. With that, we've also had an expansion plan where we're hiring more people. So anyone interested in potential roles at Unruly, please do go and have a look and reach out to the HR team. And also following on from the podcast where Kieran and I discussed why isn't Tremor International dual listed, you will note by now that we have been dual listed for nearly a month. We completed the NASDAQ listing about 3.5 weeks ago. That has been pretty much occupying a lot of our time on the exec team to make sure that we're fit and ready for that purpose, and then obviously following up that. So we've literally just released, I think this time last week, we just released our first set of results for H1 and for Q2. So that's a lot to pack in since I last saw you.
Yeah, it sounds like you've been, you know, sitting around with your feet up on the desk there, Alex.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of the things of the pandemic, right? I don't have a commute time anymore, so there's no rest. They're getting an extra three, four hours a day out of me.
To say the least, by the sounds of things, to say the least. That's big news about your dual listing. Interesting. Just going back then to sort of the maybe slightly more the machinations of your omni-channel offering, that's an interesting sort of position to be occupying at the moment, because I'm just thinking about a lot of the things that we're going to be coming up to chatting about at ATS London in November, 3rd and 4th of November, listeners, get your tickets today, which will be about, you know, where marketers and brands are looking to shift budgets and move budgets around in the wake of having to deal with privacy and, data privacy issues and consumer, and wanting to kind of, make sure that they're spending money in ways that give their consumers the feeling that they've got control over how their data is being used, right? So, you know, having an omni-channel offering is really helpful in that environment, I dare say. What are you seeing? Are you seeing, sort of particular channels popping out as areas of interest that are a bit easier to navigate around because they're not so dependent on cookies and identifiers?
Yeah, I mean, look, from an international point of view, the big areas will be audio and advanced TV. That becomes slightly more challenging in Europe when it comes to GDPR. But also from the point of view of even if you're operating within that framework of GDPR, it's more challenging around who actually owns or whose responsibility is to get that consent. Is it the OEM TV manufacturer? Is it the program owner, creator? Or is it the OTT platform sitting on top of the OEM TV? And trying to navigate that whole landscape is not only time-consuming but also quite interesting. And when that situation becomes a little bit more mainstream, we'll find that that's already there's a significant shift into exploring the possibilities around advanced TV. But I think there's there's still a lot of headroom to grow in that area. And then when you couple that with audio as well, then the you're literally providing a complete, well, almost complete user interaction for a brand, where you can then start thinking about things like sequential advertising, cross-device advertising, fit. So then you're using dynamic creative, which is fit for purpose on each device, et cetera, et cetera. And then the last missing piece would be something like dynamic out-of-home advertising, where you're able to identify the consumers or the ratio of consumers that are identifying to a particular set, and the advert changes on the building. However, that's still not necessarily mainstream. And of course, we're still in a pandemic, so there aren't necessarily the feet on the street as there were before. So from our point of view, the priority is around our advanced TV solutions with connected TV and with the OTT platforms and apps and audio. And bringing that to our clients at an international scale, or sorry, in the international markets at scale, is also something that we are actively pushing at the moment in market.
Yeah, right. And, you know, a slight little segue, but just when you're mentioning that, you know, the complexity of advanced TV in the European market, navigating your way around GDPR, anyone seen the news that apparently the UK is allegedly considering diverting from to the letter GDPR legislation and loosening up the rules around data sharing and data privacy? I mean, Lindsay, you're nodding there. Have you heard anything about that at all, Alex? I mean, you know, I know. Well, and then also the advanced TV market in the UK is different to other European countries. But yeah, heard anything about that?
Yeah, I mean, look, at the end of the day, the UK is no longer in the EU. So the GDPR governance is not technically relevant. However, the level of interaction and the amount of content owners that have multiple market content, that kind of feeds into at least having a framework that works alongside GDPR.
Yeah.
Within that framework, can the UK loosen up? Yes, of course they can, because we're able to have a govern our own rules and have sovereign right now not being in the EU. So the chances of it being able to accelerate the market here, I think, would be quite strong if they were able to provide, or if the UK government was able to provide a happy balance between what is quite hardcore draconian GDPR EU legislation. It's even harder in Germany because they didn't have their own layer on top of that. And a balance where the consumers and the advertisers and the content owners are happy with the UK. And I think that could serve as a template. So there's a real opportunity here for the UK and the UK government to refine and boost the opportunities around the whole consumption of digital content in the UK.
Yeah. Yeah. All about balance, I think, is the key phrase there. Brilliant. Thank you very much. We've run out of time. It was a pleasure to chat with you, Alex, as ever.
My pleasure.
And to see you in your swish offices there. Anyone that wants to visit Alex in the unruly office, expect a James Bond-esque experience.
More than welcome.
Complete with a very impressive suite of technology that he has to operate because the IT guy's not around. So that's probably worth a visit alone, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, look, I can press the Zoom button as well as anyone.
Brilliant. And Lindsay Rowntree, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And everybody, thanks for listening. That was this week's Mad Tech Podcast.